Well, everybody, I think let's make a prompt start. I customarily begin these events with a little bit of housekeeping, for which I hope you'll forgive me, in the, I hope, unlikely event of a fire alarm. We should leave the building by the glass doors and assemble over Gell Street outside the Student Health Centre. I trust everybody knows where the loos are. They're just a bit old doors along that end. Okay, that's the housekeeping out of the way. Good evening. My name's David Shepherd. I'm director of this, the Humanities Research Institute, or HRI, and it's my very great pleasure to welcome everybody to this, the first lecture of 2009, in a series that we've now renamed Professorial Lectures, rather than simply Inaugural Lectures. This more capacious title will allow us to continue to provide recently appointed professors in the Faculty of Arts and Humanities with the opportunity to speak about their research in what will remain, to all intents and purposes, an inaugural lecture proper. At the same time, we will take away the cover of mere passage of time from those professors who may believe that they've been here long enough to evade the obligation to spell out their vision for the development of their subject. Some of them are here as they have been before. In all cases, we'll continue to meet the faculty's aim of bringing the excellence of arts and humanities research at Sheffield to the attention of a broad audience, both within and beyond the university. In order to ensure as wide an audience and as great an impact as possible for this evening's lecture, it will, as is our usual practice, be recorded and made available as a podcast on our website as soon as practically possible. Our lecturer this evening, Professor Craig Brandis of the Department of Russian and Slavonic Studies, has been at Sheffield since 1997. In that year, he was appointed under the terms of a scheme run by what was then the Humanities Research Board of the British Academy as an institutional research fellow on a project based in the Vaccine Centre, a project with the rather clunky title, The Russian and European Contexts of the Works of Mikhail Bakhtin and the Bakhtin Circle. It's entirely proper for me to characterise the project title in those unflattering terms, for it was I who made it up, as director of the Bakhtin Centre and principal investigator on the project. Its aim was to place the works of Bakhtin and the Bakhtin Circle in their proper intellectual historical contexts, to tease out the affiliations and lineages of a set of ideas and concepts that had acquired huge, suspiciously huge, cachet and currency in a wide range of disciplines, and thereby to place them in proper perspective, to approach them from a standpoint of sobriety rather than overblown enthusiasm. A key element of this project was to translate newly available works by Bakhtin, and one of Craig's tasks was to produce the first drafts of these translations. This is no simple task, as those of you who've read Bakhtin in the original will know, and the early stages weren't without their hiccups. And I hope Craig won't object to my recalling at a fairly early stage in this introduction one of these particular hiccups. In fact, I know at the time he very sensibly took the precaution of telling colleagues about it himself in case I got there first. Not that I would have, of course. He can rest assured that my ultimate purpose in recounting this story is to draw attention to the great strengths of his work, not only on that project, but also more broadly. And I really must point out at this juncture that if the translations on which Craig spent so much of his time and energy in the early stages of that project have still not seen the light of day, then that is through no fault of his. He did all that was expected of him and more. The responsibility for that failure is entirely mine. So, in a draft encyclopedia entry on satire, Bakhtin writes of the portrayal in an 11th century work of the boundless drunkenness of the whole of the Roman Curia with the Pope at its head. Now, in a slip that Russian speakers will surely understand the reasons for, the Russian «Измерное пьянство всей римской курии во главе с папой» came out as something like the boundless drunkenness of the Pope with the head of a chicken. Now, the reason for this is that curia is the Russian word for curia, the name for curia, and the word for chicken is курица. Now, the error is doubly forgivable when we remember that Bakhtin is very well known indeed for drawing attention to grotesque portrayals of the human form. It is perfectly plausible that he might have uncovered in one of those obscure sources of which he was so very fond a representation of a chicken-headed pontiff. But I still found that slip a little bit surprising at the time. And that's because the expression that Bakhtin uses, во главе с, headed by or led by, is one that's found so often in Russian accounts of the leadership of the Communist Party. Just yesterday evening, I did a Yandex, that's the Russian Google search, on Partia во главе с Лениным, the party under the leadership of Lenin, and that produced 2 million hits. So it is something of a set expression. And I knew that Craig was thoroughly familiar with the history of the Russian Revolution and with the works of its leading lights. For he was, and still is, that rare thing, a radical, a Marxist working in a discipline area more usually populated, if by no means always by swivel-eyed reactionaries or out-and-out cold warriors, then as often as not by individuals inclined by varying combinations of experience, judgment and knowledge, or sometimes also prejudice and ignorance, to be sceptical towards the political and economic theory on which the revolution claimed to rest. And as I understand it, it was this passionate interest in the politics, no less than the culture of Russia, that led Craig Brandist, a mature graduate in English literature, by a 1988 Sussex MA, also in English literature, to a DPhil awarded in 1995, entitled Dialectics and Dialogue, the Politics of Ideological Struggle in the Work of the Bakhtin School. The writing of a thesis on this topic required, in Craig's view, that he should learn Russian. How fortunate for us it was that he did so, for it made him a prime candidate for the fellowship at Sheffield that he went on to secure. And what outstanding work he produced as institutional fellow. A steady stream of articles, published in an astounding range of peer-reviewed, high-rejection-rate journals, on myriad aspects of the Bakhtin Circle's work. This all culminated in his 2002 book, The Bakhtin Circle, Philosophy, Culture and Politics, a book that is quite simply essential reading for anyone who wishes to understand the intellectual origins and affiliations of the Bakhtin Circle's works. There were also edited books, one of them, Materializing Bakhtin, co-edited jointly with Galin Tihan, who's here this evening, a doctoral student at Oxford at the time when Craig held the Max Heywood Research Fellowship at St Anthony's College from 1994 to 1996. I can be permitted a personal note, I count myself very privileged to have been able to co-edit a book in 2004 with Craig and Galin, by this stage indisputably the two leading figures in UK Bakhtin studies. It's been no less of a privilege for me to co-supervise with Craig a number of research students, again some of them here, and to experience at close quarters his extraordinary mastery and lucid exposition of the finer nuances of Neo-Kantianism, Lebensphilosophie, or Phenomenology, to name just a few. So if that early translation solecism was a bit of a surprise, there was nothing but utter predictability, first about the university's decision to appoint Craig to a permanent lectureship at the end of his institutional fellowship, and subsequently his promotions to senior lecturer in 2003, reader in 2005, and professor of cultural theory and intellectual history in 2007. The exceptional breadth of knowledge, the unfailingly rigorous interrogation of facile binary oppositions, the sheer theoretical sophistication that Craig brings to his academic endeavours can only stand him in good stead as he faces other challenges, whether these be the leadership responsibilities that quite properly fall to the lot of professors, in Craig's case that's the directorship of the Bakhtin Centre, which has been his since late last year, or perhaps his dealings with the university as a committed high-profile officer of the Sheffield branch of the University and College Union. His intellectual strengths have certainly ensured that his research has maintained, nay, gathered momentum. In recent years, his major preoccupation has been an AHRC-funded and not at all clunkily titled project, The Rise of Sociological Linguistics in the Soviet Union, 1917 to 1938, Institutions, Ideas and Agendas. Drawing heavily on a wealth of previously unexamined materials, held in numerous archives in Russia and other parts of the former Soviet Union, this project has already yielded numerous articles, chapters and edited collections, and, of course, a monograph is nearing completion. But the most immediately forthcoming output is this evening's lecture, Science and Ideology in Early Soviet Linguistic Theory, which I now invite Professor Brandist to deliver.
Okay, thank you very much for a very generous introduction. Okay, well, these occasions, as I understand them, were generally meant to be reflections on the current state of chosen discipline or sub-discipline. And since my area of specialism these days, at least, focuses on the intellectual history of the early Soviet Russia, one can't really avoid issues of the nature of intellectual history in general, nor of the way in which the USSR has been studied in the recent past. Throughout the Cold War, there was no shortage of studies illustrating the ideological and institutional pressures on academic life in the USSR from perspectives that ranged across various parts of the political spectrum. The many Slavic departments in the USA in particular depended on Cold War funding and were particularly bastions of conservatism, giving rise to such ideologues as Richard Pipes and Condoleezza Rice. But even those less committed to a conservative agenda tended to present a facile image of official versus dissident thinkers, the former slavishly following the contours of political dogma, while the latter were genuine but oppressed intellectuals who either wrote for the draw, knowing their works couldn't be published in present circumstances, or camouflaged their dissidence beneath the formal trappings of the official ideology while subverting its deeper structure. In the realm of theories of language in the 1920s through to the 1950s, which is the focus of my research and will be my main consideration today, the official perspective was presented, of course, by Nicolai Maar's Japhetic theory, or the New Theory of Language, while the latter could be discerned in the work of exceptional individuals like the psychologist Lev Vygotsky, the philosopher and literary theorist Mikhail Bakhtin. Maarism was often presented as the officially sanctioned form of Marxism in linguistics, a brand of quackery that applied Marxist dogmas to language, making it part of the ideological superstructure of society. The latter were variously portrayed as, in the case of Vygotsky, flirting with Marxism, but their essential intellectual resources lie elsewhere, or in the case of Bakhtin, ventriloquising liberal humanist perspectives with Marxist window dressing through works that bore the names of other people. On the one side was an institutional backed dogma, the other is heroic individuals preserving scientific thinking. Of course, it's a bit of a caricature. There were a few notable, even noble, exceptions in Western scholarship, but it's not so much a caricature. When the USSR collapsed, the extremes of this position were reproduced within Russia itself, with some individuals claiming they had really been stifled and misunderstood opponents of the regime all along, and they went seeking for precursors. With the rise of Russian nationalism, figures like Bakhtin were held to have maintained a connection with pre-revolutionary religious philosophy, which had been suppressed. The works of Pavel Medvedev and Valentin Voloshinov were even republished in a series called Bakhtin Under a Mask. And as information about these figures began to emerge, improbably convoluted narratives were constructed to explain how Bakhtin was able to ghostwrite the works of well-recognised scholars in the 1920s, and how the contents of the books were not what they seemed. Embarrassingly for the nationalists, however, Bakhtin and Vygotsky both appeared to be heavily dependent on Western, especially German, scholarship. Unfortunate for the proponents of Cold War-style intellectual history, information emerged showing Bakhtin was desperately trying to find a position for himself within academic institutions rather than standing aloof from them, while Vygotsky was deeply engaged in the day-to-day running of Soviet psychology, and even made forays into the psychology of labour. Both also appeared to take the ideas of Nicolai Maar and his followers rather seriously, despite the clearly outlandish claims Maar was to make in the late 1920s, which led the emigre phonetician Nikolai Trubetskoy to pronounce Maar a madman, though unfortunately not sufficiently insane to place in an institution. Something was clearly amiss. How could somebody who received official endorsement in the 1930s while pronouncing the existence of families of languages to be a myth, contending that all languages evolved from four primordial phonemes, and were evolving from plurality to linguistic unity, and whose last writings clearly show a man in the grip of mental illness, have been admired by two scholars who have received almost universal recognition as innovative scholars in their field? Well, the first problem really lies in the psychologistic and romantic model of intellectual history that locates thoughts within the mind of the individual and overlooks the institutional dimension of research, or presents institutions as one-sidedly constraints on the pursuit of intellectual activity. Thus, the history of ideas is too often separated from the history of institutions within which the research is conducted, and which, true enough, imposes structural constraints, but also provides structural features that facilitate and enable intellectual agency. Where institutional questions have been taken seriously, this too often reproduces a simplistic dichotomy between normal institutions in which critical thinking and intellectual progress can take place, and abnormal institutions in totalitarian societies, where institutions impose ideological imperatives that distort research in ways acceptable to the political structure. There's an inadequate amount of reflexivity here. As Christopher Hutton notes in his frequently excellent study of linguistics in the Third Reich, scholars too often simply assume there's an organic wholeness, an authenticity of belief to academic endeavour, and that this is threatened by the incursions of political power. While it is indeed of considerable sociological interest to investigate the pressures on academics in the early Soviet period, and light is indeed thrown on problems and interpretation, we're in danger of invoking a counter-myth of the normal situation, the notion of the disinterested professor, free from external pressures, who pursues truth without fear or favour. Like all academic researchers, of course, Soviet scholars were not so solely motivated by disinterested search for truth, but at least partially oriented toward the acquisition and accumulation of what Pierre Bourdieu calls symbolic capital, authority, prestige, recognition, celebrity, and the like. What's important for an analysis of intellectual labour in the period is the way in which capital could be pursued within a particular institutional setting. Throughout most of the 1920s, when parallel party and state institutions maintained a tense coexistence, researchers seeking such rewards were compelled to produce works that could validly claim to be superior, more accurate and adequate representations of the world than those of their rivals. Social competition was thus channeled in a way that resulted in epistemic progress. As Bourdieu notes in one of his last books, this scientific field, the struggle for symbolic capital, takes place under the control of constitutive norms of the field and solely with the weapons approved within the field. The propositions engaged in this struggle recognise each other tacitly or explicitly as amenable to the test of coherence and the verdict of experiment. Scientific authority generally prevailed over statutory authority in determining the distribution of scientific capital. Sure enough, there were pressures, especially in the social sciences, and these became ever greater as the new bureaucratic ruling class started to crystallise at the end of the 1920s. The existence of competing discourses claiming truth about the world, about the social world, was bound to make symbolic powers feel threatened. And so the bureaucracy increasingly wanted such discourses regulated and subordinated to the prerequisites of its own reproduction. As is generally the case, this external demand found supporters within the field offering their ideological services to the dominant powers in the form of expert committees or scientific ideologies. In any case, the degree of autonomy of the field narrowed along with the appeal of the various strategies adopted to negotiate scientific and statutory authority. There is a brief period between 1929 and 1932 when Stalin's so-called revolution from above led to socio-political changes at least as far-reaching and fundamental as those of 1917, including the annexation of the state, but of state by party institutions, that some of the simplified accusations of ideological impositions on intellectuals do have some validity. But as the 1930s progressed, a narrowed but nevertheless relatively autonomous scientific field was established. Really, the repression of certain intellectuals in the late 1930s were at least largely the result of institutional politics and struggles for ascendancy within the bureaucracy, rather than representing any systematic elimination of the holders of specific points of view, on intellectual questions at least. Proportionally speaking, as many Marists as anti-Marists perished in the late 1930s as the grim process of accusation and counter-accusation developed its own logic. Russia in the 1920s saw very significant advancements in linguistic science, driven by funding made available in the most difficult conditions imaginable to address some of the problems bequeathed by the Tsarist regime. Pervasive illiteracy and a systematic Russification of subject peoples, which led the majority of indigenous languages having no standard written forms. Progressive social policy was designed to raise minority languages to the level of development where they could achieve at least formal equality with Russian, which often meant the working out and codification of written language forms of the former colonies of the Russian Empire, the spread of literacy and educational opportunities to the masses. Grants were made available for the study of hitherto uncodified languages and the emerging popular discourse, raising questions about the relationship between regional and social dialects and the standard language, and the relationship between languages and social structure in a series of collective research projects into the question, the scale of which had never previously been seen. At the same time, the new synchronic paradigm in linguistics was taken up, interrogated, revised, and developed through a series of applications that were nothing if not path-breaking. theoretical reflection followed on behind. But what was emerging was the sociolinguistic paradigm, decades before William Leboeuf, spurred on by US civil rights movement and utilising federal grants made available to address African-American educational failure and other pathologies, led to the development of what is generally now known as sociolinguistics. And the work of such linguists as Yevgeny Polivanov, Nikolai Yakovlev, Boris Larin, Lev Yakubinsky, Viktor Zhumunsky, and others' theoretical developments came together in institutions receiving grants for innovative projects that advanced scientific endeavour quite significantly. The gradual eclipse of these perspectives by Marism as the 1920s wore on was related to the ascending effectiveness of appeals to statutory as opposed to scientific authority. The famous challenge Yevgeny Polivanov made to the claims of Marism to constitute Marxism in linguistics at the Communist Academy in February 1929 was a perfect illustration of this, as Polivanov repeatedly appealed to scientific authority, while his opponents, led by the ideologue Valerian Apteker, responded with appeals to statutory authority and finally won out in the process. Underlying all this was the crystallisation of the centralised bureaucratic ruling structure and a corresponding policy shift. From 1924, the party had adopted Stalin's oxymoronic notion of socialism in one country, which was theoretically elaborated by Bukharin throughout the next few years and resulted in the notion that industrial development was synonymous with the construction of socialism. The nationality and language policies that favoured the development of the former colonies of the Russian Empire remained intact. But over time, the needs of central economic development and the coherence of the state began to assert themselves at the expense of everything else. Ultimately, the need to accumulate capital to compete militarily with more advanced hostile powers was to become the driving force of the Soviet economy and the Soviet state. And higher education and research was absorbed into this process. Research institutes now had to justify their projects according to the needs of socialist construction. And this external demand found academic supporters who offered their ideological services to the dominant powers. Institutes became ever more centralised, governed by powerful single directors who adapted the management structures of industrial enterprises and sought to bring research ever closer to the needs of economic development. Institutions were set targets, driven to compete with each other, and put forward what were called udarniki, shop workers, championing this or that bureaucratic initiative. It was in this context that Marx's suggestion that all languages were caught in an upwards movement of history, driven by economic development, converging and merging into a single language, was now presented as scientific ideology that corresponded to Stalinist political policy. Now, the subordination of research to the cause of economic development was not so much exceptional as the first example of the thorough permeation of higher education by the logic of capital accumulation. Documents in the Soviet archives that I've been through many of these from the period read just like those we have to write for HECFI, the British Research Councils. The general structures are just as familiar. It's worth dwelling on the similarities for a moment if we're going to actually assess the specificity of the Soviet case. In the USSR, the state took over finance of the whole economy, while in the UK, private finance permeated the state to an ever greater extent, until, of course, the inescapable contradictions of capitalism led the flows of finance to go into reverse as the recent economic crisis has struck. British Education Minister Charles Clarke raised it to the level of policy in 2003 when he set out one of his main goals, better progress in harnessing knowledge to wealth creation. Charles Ledbetter made the same point in a more graphic image. Universities should become the open cast minds of the knowledge economy. Initiatives like the research assessment exercise, the RAE, have led to a restructuring and redistribution of power within British universities, quite similar to those within that happened within institutions in Stalin's Russia, with the rise of a managerial elite who take decisions not on intellectual grounds but according to economic criteria, while heads of academic departments become line managers required to implement targets laid down by top management, HECFI, QAA, Department of Education and Skills. Just as in Stalin's Russia, this is accompanied by an ideological offensive, here meaning pushing academics to view students as customers, for an ethos of customer service to usurp all concerns with public service. In addition, a concerted policy not only to make universities run like business, but to cooperate with them, going under the rubric of knowledge transfer, universities conducting research that is of direct benefit to and to be used by business. It would be more accurate, therefore, to view the organisational tendency within Soviet research institutions in the late 1920s as pioneering a role for universities akin to that of modern capitalism, where the imperative for capital accumulation trumps all other considerations. Clearing aside the misleading terms in which Cold War rivals posed the issue, we can see that the interpretation of the interpenetration of capital and state reached its zenith in the USSR, and it has taken some time for the concentration of capital to reach such a level as it is reflected in the organisation of education, as the state stands to perform to perform the service roles that the private sector can no longer manage. The parallels are striking. It even trickles down to such trends as encouraging competition between institutions, the lurching of one target to another, even if they are inconsistent with each other, the proliferation of champions for this or that management initiative, and such absurdities as the RAE, providing motivations for managers to massage their submissions, just as Stalinist enterprise managers used to try to deceive their central planners. Nor is the narrowing of the ideological field within institutions that clearly took place as a result of these reforms so exceptional. Recent research has shown that the RAE has led to a decline in recruitment of so-called heterodox economists in favour of neoclassical economists, as university departments seek to maximise submissions to neoclassical journals that form the so-called diamond list for that discipline. The main difference is that resistance to such policies in Stalin's Russia was almost impossible. Of course, while the increase in subordination to the needs of capital accumulation has narrowed the autonomy of academics, few of us, I think, would go so far as to argue that our work no longer has any intellectual validity. For the same reason, we shouldn't simplify the ideological imperative in Soviet intellectual life. Just because intellectuals were dragooned into narrower channels and posed their research in the way they did, does not mean that their work can be reduced to the polemical statements that they made. But there's no denying the entwinement of intellectual and institutional factors, even if we must take care not to oversimplify them. So if we now turn to the case of Marism, which I'm going to spend the rest of the time today speaking about, we can see that while it certainly did get caught up in the ideological and institutional specificities of the time, many scholars really did find aspects of the doctrine that they genuinely admired and that we should not easily dismiss. Much of it derived from Marx's questioning of the methods and assumptions of philology at the end of the 19th century, to which he responded with increasing hostility. And his illustration that philology was not the rational, detached, and objective discipline that its proponents claimed. Philology in late Tsarist Russia was dominated by scholars who worked either on the very ancient pre-literary epochs, if they were trying to reconstruct proto-languages, or else the less ancient but still rather distant past when, through the study of written documents, they sought to re-establish the historical phonetics and historical grammar of this or that language. In accordance with the imperial project, they regarded Russian as the most worthy language for study, with other languages and cultures regarded as peripheral. Contemporary spoken language became the object of systematic study only in the years immediately preceding the revolution, to which even study of Russian dialects was generally carried out from the perspective of linguistic relict forms, supplemented with data from written sources. Russian philology thus followed the main line of Indo-Europeanism by endorsing the positive attempt to establish the rules by which modern scientific thought liberated itself from the whole of mythical and metaphysical thinking. In the age of classical imperialism, this corresponded with the championing of those features that major European powers helped distinguish themselves from the more backward states and justified their civilizing mission. But this eulogy for science was combined with a romantic source for original linguistic roots from the time close to the birth of language as such. The discovery of Sanskrit and the Vedas led on to systematic comparison between Indian and European languages and myths. But this was then combined with that ideology that identifies a single language with a single people, an ideology that probably originated with Condillac, but finds its definitive statements in Herder, Humboldt, and the German Romantics. Exported to Russia by Western-educated intellectuals, This conception of propagated the view that the most significant languages of Europe derives from that Indo-European or Aryan ancestors who had conquered vast swathes from India to the Atlantic. Russia, therefore, took its place among the imperial powers of the European continent and did so as inheritance of the polytheistic dynamism of the Indo-Europeans that drove mastery over nature, exploitation of time and space, the invention of mythology, art and science. This was in contrast, of course, to the Semites, who remained in one place, attached to their languages, cultures and monotheistic religions, and in their immobility remained outside the universal historical progress. The dynamism of one was contrasted with the stagnation of the other. As Maurice Ollenden reminds us, while the proponents of philological science claim to be casting the light of rational thought on mythical beliefs and religions, stripping away dogma and superstition, the discipline itself had, of course, arisen from studies of the classics and biblical exegesis. It was the first secular science to be accepted by the Christian Church, with matters of dogma depending on philological issues and grammatical details. The giants of Indo-European philology, like the Oxford-based Friedrich Max Müller and the French Orientalist Ernst Renan, viewed their discipline as the starting point for a science of human origins. And this recast and reinforced the opposition of Indo-European and Semitic languages and cultures by highlighting different families of language, which could be explained through historical and geographical factors, leading to systematic borrowings or descent from a common ancestor, or some combination of the two. The reconstruction of Indo-European was viewed by Max Müller in particular as a search for that pre-lapsarian language that had laid the foundations of European languages. Mar's mother tongue was Georgian, which most linguists regarded as an isolated language, quite alien to Indo-European, but also unconnected to any other language group. As Lawrence Thomas argues in his interest in intellectual history of Mar, instead of being consigned to a cultural backwater, Mar was determined that his mother tongue, Georgian, should be linked to one of the great cultural linguistic families and that the peoples of the region should be assigned a central role in the creative remodelling of European and world culture. While still in his early 20s, Mar was suggesting that Georgian word stock and grammatical structure were in some way related to the Semitic family of languages. But he put this thesis on ice while he completed his university education, which culminated in the enormous three-volume philological study on the Parables of Vardan, in which he collected and collated various redactions of medieval Armenian tales and carried out comparisons with Arabic and Syrian literary monuments. This was immediately recognised as a classic when it appeared in 1899 and revealed that while basing his comparisons on material from literature and folklore, Mar's intellectual impulses were indeed of some significance. He began a distinguished career in philology and archaeology, but then resumed his work on the relationship between Georgian and Semitic languages. Utilising terminology that was well known in philology at the time, Mar argued that Georgian was the most characteristic representative of a separate linguistic branch, which he called the Japhetic branch, and which was related to Semitic by having a common ancestor in the so-called Noetic group, the terminology here deriving from the two sons of Noah, Shem and Japheth. Mar relied on phonetic and morphological evidence for this thesis, and while his linguistic methodology, we must say, left much to be desired, his factual knowledge of the Caucasian languages was undoubtedly superior to those few linguists who did pay attention to such languages. The Caucasus region obviously posed a particularly complex problem for linguists, since more than 50 languages can still be found in the Caucasian mountain valleys, foothills and adjoining plains. Languages include Indo-European, Turkic, Mongolic, Semitic families and at least 37 indigenous so-called Ibero-Caucasian languages. These languages of the colonised people have been given a very low priority by linguists. And Mar was very quickly able to make his mark in promoting their study. It was therefore understandable that Mar's most astute critic at the end of the 1920s, Yevgeny Polovanov, directed his critique at Mar's later ideas, but made clear that he regarded the discovery of Japhetic language as a comparative grammar of South Caucasian languages to be a great achievement. Marr's engagement with Indo-European is valuable less because of the specific positions he adopted than the extent to which he instituted a critique of the assumptions and structures of philology as a discipline at a time when such a critique had never been advanced in any really sustained way. But Marr's critique was of a very specific kind. It constituted an ideology critique, since it started from the suspicion that the autonomy of validity claimed by contemporary philology is an illusion, because secret interests and power claims have crept into its pores. To paraphrase Jürgen Habermas's characterization of the work of Horkheimer and Adorno, Marr aims to show that behind the back of the theory, as it were, there lies hidden an inadmissible mixture of power and validity, and that it still owes its reputation to this. This operation is not in itself a theory competing with another theory, but rather making use of certain theoretical assumptions, disputing the truth of the theory by exposing its untruthfulness. Marr thus focuses on Indo-European philology, showing that while it presupposes a demythologized understanding of the world, it is still ensnared by myth. And he does this by pointing out a putatively overcome category mistake. Now, this first becomes apparent in his work on Armenia, the phonology and morphology of which most linguists at the turn of the 20th century regarded as totally explicable on the basis of their Indo-European heritage. But to Marr, these Indo-Europeanists were, and I quote, rapacious imperialists whose sound laws were merely attempts to extend the domain of Indo-European languages, unquote. Marr now joined those mainly Jewish researchers who sought to undermine the caricatures of race psychology by turning to an alternative form of nascent social psychology, the Völkerpsychologie that had been developed by Heymann Steintal and Moritz Lazarus. Steintal and Lazarus had precisely aimed to counter the anti-Semitism implicit and often explicit in Indo-Aryan studies by showing that however different the culture of different peoples may appear, the same laws govern the life of the soul, as they called it, of all. And this fitted in with the ideas of Herman Spencer, whom Marr claimed to be the most important influence on his intellectual development. Spencer claimed that the laws of thought are everywhere the same. In common with a whole generation of Russian Oriental scholars and philologists of the time, Marr absorbed the principles of Völkerpsychologie and mined the trend for its potential to undermine colonial ideology. The first attempt to subvert Indo-Europeanism was by proposing an alternative sense to Sanskrit from which he could consider the relations between languages, as well as suggesting that the Georgian language belongs to a distinct family of Japhetic languages. He also raised the anomalous positions of Basque and Etruscan. Languages spoken at the heart of Europe are allegedly having more features in common with Caucasian than Indo-European languages. This served to disrupt the coherence of the Indo-European narrative, since we were no longer presented with single family of languages with just a few isolated and unrelated pockets elsewhere. In accordance with the principles of Völkerpsychologie, he then proceeded to argue a radical relativism, according to which Indo-European linguists were simply unable to understand Japhetic languages, since Japhetic had its own laws, psychology, and mode of evolution that was at odds with Indo-European languages. This was later modified into the argument that as long as Indo-European linguists remained wedded to race psychology, they would be unable to understand Japhetic languages, since in order to recognise the universal laws of the soul, they would need to abandon their ideological framework. Marr's very use of terminology was designed to disrupt the coherence of the Indo-European narrative. When he invoked Japheth, Noah's favourite son, to designate Caucasian languages, he plugged into a history of linguistic speculation that underlay Indo-European linguistics. The idea that Japheth had preserved the original pre-lapse Aryan language in its purity and had laid the foundations of European languages independent of Semitic influence was well ingrained by the beginning of the 20th century. Marr thus aimed to undermine the very foundations of Indo-European linguists by reversing the relations between European and Semitic that was central to it and bringing out the ideological implications and the institutional embeddedness of the Indo-European paradigm. Marr's schema was here no more speculative or ideological than the narrative that lay behind Indo-Europeanism. By 1908, Marr was arguing that Japhetic and Indo-European languages have separate origins, which sometimes crossed, to form languages such as Armenian, where the Japhetic and Indo-European elements corresponded to the language and of the oppressed and oppressor peoples, respectively. This attempt to justify the role of the Japhetites played in history led in 1921 to the assertion that they were the most ancient inhabitants of the Mediterranean and Middle East, and that to them belong the main cultural achievements of the ancient world. I notice my handout still lying on the table, so that could be passed around the other things. I do that now because there's a quotation on the back. There are a few quotations on the back here, one of which is the one I'll just start reading now. This was Mahler in 1921. It has already been established that it was the Japhetic family, the Japhetic literary milieu, that created and developed the firm foundations of modern civilization, and that it was mixing with the Japhetites that passed on cultural nobility to the Indo-European races, that it crossed with them and produced the Greeks and Romans, the early appearance of civil society on the world arena, which was historically known in later times to the Romance and German peoples. Now, what distinguished Mahler's work from the Indo-European linguist was not the entwinement of linguistics and ideology, but the low level of technical competence, and in some cases indifference, with which he went about validating his claims. On meeting with the Germanist Fedor Braun in Leipzig at the end of 1920s, they had known each other since their days as junior researchers at St. Petersburg University, Mahler noted that rarely in his life had he spent such time with such a refined Indo-European linguist, and marvelled at the care that Braun took to explain to his audience the need to consider the dual nature of the origins of the German people. While Mahler was clearly more than competent when dealing with the languages of the Caucasus, his grounding in general linguistic theory was, to say the least, questionable. But it didn't restrain him from making increasingly extravagant generalisations. And so the Japhetic family became ever more extended, sometimes without the newly annexed languages having been subject to any systematic study at all. During the First World War, the family moved beyond the Caucasus, incorporating Basque and Etruscan in 1920, with ad hoc methodological adjustments being made along the way. Subsequent developments, however, strongly affirm that we're not dealing with a meeting of ideological doctrine and objective scholarship. Between 1920 and 1923, these are key years, Fedor Braun was based in Leipzig, where he acted as a propagandist for Japhetic theory in Western Europe. His interest in considering ethnological and linguistic issues together had been focused by his time with Mahler at St. Petersburg Neo-Philological Society, and he had independently reached the conclusion that a significant portion of German words derived from earlier inhabitants of Europe than before the arrival of the Indo-Europeans. When he encountered Mahler's then new ideas about Japhetic inhabitants and the crossing of languages, he was immediately struck by the convergence and began to introduce Japhetic terms into his work. Braun and Mahler worked out a plan to acquaint the Western European world of scholars with Japhetic theory by means of a series of publications called Japhetic Studies for Language and the Culture of the Eurasians. The alliance couldn't last long, however, because, well, Braun cancelled diplomacy and his relations with Indo-European linguists. Mahler became increasingly belligerent with anyone who had doubted his assertions and demanded firm evidence that Japhetites were indeed the original inhabitants of Europe. In support of the policy of a constructive dialogue with Indo-Europeanists, Braun reported that some linguists, like Edward Sievers, admitted the possibility of the presence of Japhetic elements in Indo-European language, but he regarded it to be unproven. Braun suggested to Mahler that the main reason Western specialists were unconvinced by Japhetic theory was the absence of a general work on the theory, and he particularly recommended a comparative grammar of Japhetic languages, the absence of which had been particularly raised. Others, however, were more hostile, even when they were on thin ice themselves. As Braun reported in a letter to Mahler, and this is there on the sheet, speaking about a particular German Slavist at the time, that fool Mayer announced with pompous insistence that he would believe Japhetic theory only when there lay before him a completed dictionary of Japhetic languages. I replied that I was afraid he would have to wait a rather long time for that, and I was surprised that he could work on Indo-European linguistics not having a completed comparative dictionary of Indo-European languages in front of him. Ma responded with considerable indignation that a textbook, especially written in a foreign language, should be required of someone holding a doctorate in the corresponding languages, a member of the Academy of Sciences, a professor of the Faculty of Oriental Studies, in order to be considered competent to pronounce on such matters. Certainly not beyond the realm of possibility that hostility among German scholars towards these conservative German scholars towards the USSR and the political trend it represented in contemporary Germany contributed to hostile reception of Ma's ideas. But more worrying was when Brown reported that several times he encountered objections that the term Japhetic family was inappropriate because, and I quote, it only applies to old Jewish tradition, not having Europe in view, but only a Semitic cultural horizon. Not unreasonably, Brown concluded, there's undoubtedly a certain anti-Semitism here. By the end of 1922, Brown was increasingly pessimistic about the prospects for Japhetic theory in the absence of support among Western scholars. This is the final quote there. Ma's theory, as they call it, must be converted into Japhetic theory, or it will be exhausted as soon as you leave the stage. It will remain merely an episode in the history of science. An interesting episode, for sure, and one that raised many questions, but did not provide a final answer to any of the questions it raised in the eyes of its readers. Ma, though, was now content to let theory develop free from those who wanted to smother or convert it into something for themselves, as he put it. The break was now complete. But when the theory did so develop, Ma's ideas were still to face sustained opposition at home. A combination of his intellectual hubris, volatile character, the hostile reception of his work by Western scholars, who, in many ways, confirmed Ma's own preconceptions about them, made any meaningful dialogue between the two trends impossible. In 1923, he publicly announced his complete break with Indo-European linguistics by proclaiming, firstly, that Indo-European languages were not a special racial family of languages, but rather a stage in linguistic development, and that, two, Indo-Europeanism is flesh and bone, the expression of bourgeois society, built on the oppression of the peoples of the East by the murderous colonial policies of European nations. It was now that Ma fully adopted the comparative method of the British evolutionary anthropologists and their associates, Herbert Spencer, Edward Tylor, Andrew Lang and others, and counterposed this to the established methods of comparative linguistics and mythology. Semantic material was pronounced to be immortal. The doctrine of survivals was adopted to claim that traces of earlier stages could be found in the strata of modern languages. This was now named the paleontological analysis, and the Japhetic family began to annex Indo-European languages more aggressively, with little or no evidence adduced. Finally, paleontological analysis led Ma to conclude the very notion of families of languages, along with the thesis of the proto-language, had to be abandoned, since in actuality languages were evolving from diverse origins toward unity. It's worth noting here that there's no Marxism in any of this, but only positivist evolutionism. When Ma introduced the notion that there were qualitative jumps in the evolution, and that language derived from labour cries and developed in accordance with the development of technology, there was similarly nothing particularly Marxist about all of that. The former was general Hegelianism, the latter derived from the philosophy of technology associated with the German advocate of the philosophy of Schopenhauer, Ludwig Noire. Japhetic theory had now become the new theory of language. Ma's opponents were dismayed, and some looked for the origin of these ideas in unconventional places, and they found parallels that suggested certain ideas were actually widespread, even amongst the very philologists that he opposed. Georgi Danilov and Timofey Lomtiev, leaders of the group Yazyk Front, Language Front, who opposed Ma in 1930, suggested that when Ma inverted the Indo-Europeanist narrative, according to which a variety of languages developed from a single proto-language, to argue that all languages were actually developing from variety to unity, he was just echoing the works of Ernest Renan. Danilov presented no textual evidence, but my own investigations do indeed confirm that Renan did actually argue that, and this is a quotation from him, that the distinctiveness of races understood as a group of people who spoke a common language or related dialects gradually fades and will ultimately disappear. The future will see a homogeneous humanity in which all the native rivulets will coalesce into a great stream and all the memory of diverse origins will be lost. With the establishment of the new theory, then rigour and restraint was abandoned and bizarre and even crackpot formulations began to emerge. The obvious example of such extremities is the notorious four-element theory, according to which all languages were held to have derived from the four primordial diffuse exclamations, Sal, Ber, Yon, and Rosh. The linguistic paleontologist could then excavate all linguistic phenomena until these totemic elements were revealed. And in the 1930s and 40s, a whole generation of Soviet linguists were indeed trained to do precisely this. Passing remark of Antonio Gramsci, I think, is appropriate in this case. To reconstruct a megatherium or a mastodon from a tiny bone was Cuvier's special gift. This is the founder of primate paleontology. But it may also happen that from a piece of a mouse's tail, one might reconstruct a sea serpent. Mars certainly remained a talented, intuitive thinker. Vladimir Alpatov not unreasonably suggests Ma well have been, may well have been a genius, as many of his contemporaries thought. He had an extraordinary capacity for organisational work and made some remarkable conjectures. But he was so confident in his methodological principles, he rarely restrained himself by placing each item in their proper place according to a perceived totality and thereby tended to construct sea serpents. So what does all this examination of Ma's work in its historical context really show us? Firstly, it was a flawed ideology critique of Indo-Europeanism, which highlighted such ideologically charged propositions as the identification of a single people with a single language, that some of the same social processes operating in the construction and the creation of linguistic boundaries are also evident in the construction of disciplinary boundaries. And here it really anticipates moves in critical linguistic anthropology, such as the work of Susan Gull and Catherine Woolard, around issues of linguistic ideology. Ma's work is very prescient in this respect. Ma's revelation of the entwinement of Indo-European thesis and European imperial project strongly anticipates Edward Said's approach to the work of Western Orientalists, as a trend which naturalised Eurocentrism and in so doing sought to legitimise and authorise imperialism. For Said, it was, and I quote, "the extraordinarily rich and celebrated cultural position of philology that endowed Orientalism with its most important technical characteristics." As Vera Toltz, who we have coming to speak for us later in this semester, has shown, there's even a historical link here, since one of the authors who Edward Said developed, Anwar Abdul Malek, borrowed directly from Russian scholarship of the late 1920s and early 1930s, particularly from Sergei Oldenburg and from Ma. Thus, for all of the often bizarre formulations, Ma's work contains elements that anticipate some of the most significant trends in linguistic anthropology and linguistic politics, as well in fields like in post-colonial studies. The fact that this gives us grounds to reconsider the intellectual the development of intellectual history outside the former USSR is in itself sufficient grounds for us to take Maoism seriously as a historical phenomenon and to rethink the principles on which contemporary cultural theory were grounded. But Ma's ideology critique was itself entwined with the myths of Romantic nationalism. And when the fundamental break with Western linguistics came in 1924, he was already building for himself an administrative career in the crystallising bureaucratic structure and incorporating the myths that have justified it. The opposition of Japhetidology and Indo-Europeanism came to be mapped onto that between Soviet proletarian science and Western bourgeois science, which had this opposition, of course, had originated perhaps in Bogdanov's work and was reformulated by Bukharin into official Leninism in the 1920s. The fact that this doctrine triumphed and was recognised as Leninism, even though it factually actually contradicted Lenin's own views on the matter, is especially important if we're to understand the processes at work. There was no shortage of opportunist ideologists like Aptekar, who were only too keen to elaborate Maoism as a useful scientific ideology, in Bourdieu's sense, in journalistic form. For his part, Ma now began consciously to draw upon Bukharin's work to undergird the already prepared formulations with superficially Marxist notions. Even at the time, these propositions by Bukharin were recognised by some more sophisticated Marxists like Georg Lukács and Gramsci, actually more closely based on evolutionary positivism linked to economic determinations than anything based on the mutually conditioning dialectics of Marxism. As nationality policy and the ideology of socialism in one country increasingly favoured Marx's formula of languages develop in accordance with economic development, Marx accumulated supporters within the bureaucracy. And while this allowed him to build up a network of institutes at which his own theories were given pride of place, it didn't in itself enable Marx to secure the hegemony in the field until statutory authority finally usurped scientific authority in 1929 through to 1932. As with the no less ideologically biased Indo-Europeanists, however, the studies that Marx inaugurated led to some significant epistemic progress. Marx's institutes were populated by many serious and talented scholars who verbally affirmed Marx's ideology critique while adopting and adapting aspects of Marx's work to their own ends. This went far beyond linguistics into the study of myth, folklore and literature. Here, paleontological analysis of literary plots and poetic imagery resulted in some of the most valuable and original forms of cultural theory of the period. Building on the doctrine of survivals developed by British evolutionary anthropology and the historical poetics of Andrew Lang and the father of comparative literature, Alexander Veselovsky, Marx, like Israel Frank Kamieniecki, Kitty Megrelidze, Alden Freudenberg, trace the evolution and morphology of key semantic clusters over time and space with reference to the functions certain objects played in socioeconomic life. Only now is this work beginning to receive some of the recognition it deserves, though much of the work dealing with this still tends to repeat the problems of the study of intellectual history that I began my lecture. Much of this valuable work continued into the 1940s, along with typological study of grammatical categories and discursive formations. It's therefore little wonder that figures like Bakhtin and Vygotsky drew on such work. But it's also notable that Marx's most ludicrous formations, like the notorious four-element theory, were largely ignored after Marx's death. While Marx's insistence on the class nature of language, that different classes speak different languages, was quietly modified into a general sociology of language. Therefore, we can see Marxism emerging in a complex and dynamic intellectual sphere in which ideological and institutional factors were integrated at a molecular level, as it were. There are some general points that arise from this. Intellectual activity and institutions only appear together, mutually conditioning in each other, but irreducible to each other. To hypostatise one or the other may suit certain ideological goals at certain times, but the distortions that result do violence to the object of study and is the product of inadequately reflexive intellectual activity. Similarly, to identify factors that exist only in dialectical unity, as in the Cold War totalitarian theory of the USSR, robs us of any ability to explain the dynamics of intellectual life or indeed social change. The other side of such formulations is, of course, the counter-myth of the disinterested scholarship of the West, which may be superficially reassuring but breeds complacency about the pressures on intellectual activity that we're all subject to. The history of Marxism sure enough constitutes a cautionary tale of the entwinement of institutional imperatives and scholarship. But an adequate critique has to recognise that it was to a considerable extent shaped by Western European scholarship who claimed to transcend any such prosaic concerns, but was equally entangled in structures of power. There's a certain fragility to the scientific field that we all need to recognise, and we need to be on guard and ready to defend it. Fortunately, we're in a better position to do so than were intellectuals in Stalin's Russia. Thank you.
Characteristic combination of archival research, intellectual rigour and purposeful polemic. the kind that those of us who know you well are quite used to hearing. I think it's clear to all of us how the Bakhtin Centre will progress under the leadership of Brandis, all 5 years of Brandistan, as the Russians would say, and indeed how it will not progress. I think we can take great encouragement from that. It's customary in these occasions that we don't interrogate our speaker, but that there's an opportunity for informal exchange over a glass of wine, which awaits us outside. Before we go there, could I just draw your attention to other forthcoming seminars, some of which are to be held here in the HRI, associated with, in fact, the Centre for Research in Freemasonry and Fraternalism, and also the Department of Russian and Slavonic Studies. Craig has referred to the forthcoming seminar of Yellow Points. There are some cards here which set out, give details of a series of talks in the Centre for Research into Freemasonry and Fraternalism, which focus on Freemasonry and Fraternalism in Eastern Europe and in particular Russia over the coming spring semester. So we hope that as many as possible of you will come to those. So please do take one of these as you leave. Okay, I think now is the time to say thank you again to Craig and to invite you all through for a glass of wine. Thanks very much, Craig.